Well, we were talking about ATP synthase, which is what's pictured here, one copy of it in slide 18. And this operates in what part of the overall process? Where are we in the overall process right now? Well, yes, that's where we are spatially, but I mean in the process. What part of the process? Oxidative phosphorylation, which is part three of cellular respiration, right? And remember that oxidative phosphorylation has two parts to it. What are those? That's right. Electron transport, which is what we covered last time already. And the second part of oxidative phosphorylation is chemiosmosis. This is where ATP synthase is used. The purpose of electron transport is to convert what is left of the usable energy that hasn't already been put into the form of ATP, which is the reduced coenzymes that accumulated starting at glycolysis onward, put that energy into the form of energy that ATP synthase can exploit. And that form of energy is a proton gradient. So that's what electron transport does. By transporting the electrons to release their energy, protons get pumped through the inner mitochondrial membrane, creating a gradient for protons where the higher concentration of protons is in the intermembrane space. That's where they just got pumped to, the protons. So they want to come back in to the mitochondrial matrix, the yellow. In other words, they want to diffuse. A gradient is the tendency for diffusion. But remember back in lab when we first talked about transport processes that's not enough for diffusion to actually happen. The other requirement for diffusion to actually occur is that there has to be a way for the particle to get from A to B. So the protons want to get back into the matrix, and they are plenty small enough because they're protons. They're even smaller than an atom. They're just a single subatomic particle. Plenty small enough, but they're pretty well blocked by the phospholipid bilayer, which is the thing holding them back from diffusing down their gradient. And the reason is that protons are fully charged. They're positively charged, and they therefore do not want to be around these tails in the thickness of the inner membrane. Nevertheless, the gradient is the tendency for them to diffuse. Well, ATP synthase molecules, many, many identical copies of the thing you're looking at here, provide the only places in the membrane where these protons can get through down their gradient back into the mitochondrial matrix from where they were previously pumped. All right? They're operating pretty much like turnstiles. You know, you have a huge crowd of people before first pitch trying to get into the ballpark. That's the gradient. There's a high concentration outside. They want to diffuse into the stadium. But the only places they're allowed through are the turnstiles. Okay? Similar thing happening here. There are two parts to ATP synthase. It's a molecular machine because it has moving parts. But the two parts, and these parts are made of large protein complexes. The blue and purple are the two parts. The two parts are called the rotor and the stator. Same exact names as basic parts of a motor, right? A motor has a rotor and a stator. The stator is static. That's why it's called that. Static means it's not moving. It's held in place. The rotor rotates with respect to the stator. Okay, now, these are embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane, which is the same place where all the copies of the electron transport chains are. They're just not shown in this picture. The rotor has a shaft, which is connected to a complex of catalytic knobs. Each of these catalytic knobs, which are in the matrix, they're not actually embedded in the membrane, they're sticking into the matrix. The fact that they're called catalytic knobs should tell you that they are acting as enzymes, right? They're catalytic. Well, you know how enzymes work, but these enzymes are a little bit special. We've already talked about the fact that shape is everything for enzyme function, right? Remember we talked about control of enzymes, how you can deform the active site and therefore turn the enzyme off. Well, these are normally off enzymes, so to speak, meaning that unless this thing is turning, these enzymes can't work. Each enzyme is just another copy of, they're all copies of the same enzyme, but there's several in this overall rotor. And what happens is that if this rotor is allowed to spin, that will deform each catalytic knob in just the right way, change its shape in just the right way, that it will be able to bind its substrates, which are ADP and inorganic phosphate. Remember that it's called synthase because it's synthesizing or bringing together two things. The two things it's bringing together are ADP and inorganic phosphate to produce ATP. But that won't happen unless this catalytic knob is turning, because as it turns, it gets deformed because of its relationship with the stator. Well, what makes this turn is the diffusion of protons down their gradient. So the end of the rotor that is embedded in the membrane provides the turnstile through which these protons can get back into the matrix. And that's the only place they can get through, which is why the cell ensures that the energy of the gradient isn't wasted. If these protons were able to leak through the membrane easily, then all that energy would be wasted. It wouldn't be put to work. But instead, this thing works very much like a water wheel. You know, if you put in the effort of carrying water uphill, that's storing that effort, that energy, in a gravitational potential gradient. If you then pour the water over a water wheel, it will turn the wheel, and that wheel can be attached to something to do some sort of work, like lifting something or grinding something. Same thing is happening here. The work performed is a lot more ATP molecules being made. And even though they are indistinguishable from the ATP molecules made earlier, these are made a little bit differently. This is not substrate level phosphorylation, because the phosphate isn't first being carried by a substrate that hands it off to ADP. Instead, it's inorganic phosphate. And that's why this method of producing ATP is not called substrate level phosphorylation, it's called oxidative phosphorylation. The oxidative part of it came in the earlier step. Electron transport is a sequence of redox reactions, so that's where the oxidative part of it comes into play. But the oxidative transfer of electrons allows for the pumping of protons that provides the energy by diffusion for this chemiosmosis to work. And by far, most of the ATPs that can be produced if glucose is completely dismantled, completely oxidized, is in this final step. There's only a few made earlier. This is the big payoff, in other words, in terms of using all of the energy that those NADHs and FADH2s are carrying. So now in slide 19, we can put the two parts of oxidative phosphorylation together with one picture. The two parts are electron transport and chemiosmosis. Electron transport is the process. The thing that actually does it is called the electron transport chain. But this is the same membrane. Like I said earlier, ATP synthase is right by copies of electron transport chain, and there's many, many copies of both of these components. But what's happening here is that NADH, which is produced in glycolysis, it's produced in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, and it's produced in the citric acid cycle, plus FADH2, which is produced in the citric acid cycle, all are high energy taxis because they're full of passengers, electrons and protons from the fuel originally. They are all driving to the destination of electron transport chains. And they drop those electrons off, which get transported from member to member. That releases energy and allows for complexes 1, 3, and 4 to work as pumps to pump the other part, besides the electrons, which are the protons that came from the fuel, through the intermitochondrial membrane from the matrix to the intermembrane space. That creates the proton gradient, which is the tendency for those protons to diffuse back into the matrix, but the only places they're allowed back in are the copies of ATP synthase. That spins the rotor, which deforms the active sites in just the right way to synthesize ADP and inorganic phosphate into ATP. And that is the end of cellular respiration, but let's review the whole thing here in slide 20. Actually, this is a review of the entire process, not just cellular respiration. So remember that the overall process is the complete oxidation of glucose. That, you know, if you want to think about it in outline form, that's the main heading, complete oxidation of glucose. It has two subparts. The first is glycolysis. The second is cellular respiration. And they not only accomplish different things, they happen in different spaces. Glycolysis happens first, and it happens in the cytosol. It is a 10-step process, like we talked about, that partially accomplishes the breakdown of the carbon skeleton and the dehydrogenation of the fuel. So in 10 steps, glucose, the main fuel, gets broken, 1,6-carbon glucose gets broken down into 2,3-carbon pyruvates. And in the process, some ADP gets phosphorylated into ATP, and some NAD plus gets reduced into NADH and H plus. The valuable things at this point are, of course, the ATP. It's part of the goal. The NADH, carrying a lot of energy, and the pyruvate. Everything that glycolysis spits out is still valuable stuff in terms of energy, because pyruvate is not completely spent fuel. If a cell is capable, though, it is definitely worth continuing the breakdown of what is now pyruvate, what's left of the fuel. And that requires part two of the overall process, which is cellular respiration. And that happens, if we're talking about a eukaryotic cell doing this, in a different compartment, namely the mitochondrion. And so cellular respiration is part two of the overall process, but it is broken down into three parts. And the three parts are the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate first, which is this white arrow, that not only brings the fuel, pyruvate, into the mitochondrion, but partially dismantles it. It takes off one of the carbons and two oxygens with it. It decarboxylates it, in other words. And that's why it will yield some CO2, which is completely spent fuel, but it will leave still valuable fuel, a 2-carbon compound called acetyl, that gets picked up by a coenzyme called coenzyme A, and when it's full of its passenger, its acetyl passenger, the whole thing is called acetyl coenzyme A. That's going to drive to the second process, part of cellular respiration, but the other important thing that the oxidative decarboxylation does is reduce more NAD plus into NADH and H plus. Okay? The citric acid cycle is part two of cellular respiration. So acetyl coenzyme A, or the acetyl taxi, I mean the coenzyme A taxi drops off acetyl to the citric acid cycle. And that's what's left of the fuel at this point. There's only two carbons, but there's two of these acetyls per glucose, right? Because we made two pyruvates, and each pyruvate gets decarboxylated. So as the citric acid cycle proceeds through its steps, the dismantling of the carbon skeleton and the dehydrogenation of the fuel is completed. So more CO2 comes off, and at this point, for each glucose, you have six CO2s, six completely spent fuel. The energy goes into making more ATP at the citric acid cycle. It's produced by substrate-level phosphorylation, just like it was in glycolysis. But it also accomplishes, even more importantly in terms of energy, reduction of more coenzyme. More NAD plus gets reduced into NADH and H plus, and FAD gets reduced into FADH2. So now we have all kinds of NADH and H plus, plus some FADH2. That's what's usable in terms of energy that from glucose originally that hasn't already been put into ATP form. We wasted some as heat, of course. And all of these taxis, both fleets, NAD and FAD, are driving to the same place, which is part three of cellular respiration. In other words, oxidative phosphorylation. But specifically, the part of oxidative phosphorylation that these taxis are driving to is the first part of oxidative phosphorylation, which is electron transport. They drop their electrons and protons off at electron transport chains. The electrons get transported down the chains. That releases the energy, allowing for the pumping of the protons, the other passengers these taxis dropped off. The protons get pumped through the membrane from the matrix into the intermembrane space, and they therefore want back in, and they are only allowed in through the ATP synthase molecules embedded in that same membrane, and that diffusion of those protons down their gradient is the chemiosmosis part of oxidative phosphorylation. That's what spins the rotors of ATP synthase, deforming their catalytic knobs in such a way that they can synthesize ADP and inorganic phosphate into a lot more ATP. Now, look at the numbers here. Oh, well over 90% of the ATP produced per molecule of glucose is in this final step, which requires cellular respiration. That's why I said that after glycolysis is done, it's certainly worth it if the cell is capable of doing so to keep using what's left of the fuel and undergo cellular respiration, not just stop at glycolysis. All right, now, glycolysis is not actually part of cellular respiration, even though some books say it is. It's not. Glycolysis happens whether cellular respiration occurs or not, and as a matter of fact, it happens in cells that aren't even capable of cellular respiration. So glycolysis has to happen, or the cell is dead, and therefore the organism, especially if it's unicellular. But glycolysis requires inputs for it to proceed. Of course, one input important is glucose itself. You can't have glycolysis without the fuel. That's not enough, though. Remember what the three important outputs of glycolysis are. They are pyruvate, ATP, and NADH and H+. Well, what are the inputs? What are the inputs into glycolysis? How can you have an output of NADH and H+? What would the input have to be? The corresponding input. NAD+. You have to have, in other words, empty taxis coming into glycolysis, or glycolysis will shut down. Okay, remember I talked about the only reason we need oxygen, the only reason we breathe is to serve as the final electron acceptor in the electron transport chains? Because you have, in order for electron transport to continue, the last member of the chain has to be able to dump its electrons off, or it can't receive any more. That's the job of oxygen. or for the species that use something other than oxygen in their respiration method. There has to be some external electron acceptor. If it's not available, then that would fill up the electron transport chains, and there would be no more pumping of protons, no more chemiosmosis. Cellular respiration would shut down. All right? Glycolysis does not require oxygen. But glycolysis would shut down also if cellular respiration shut down, if it weren't for a secondary possibility, a secondary process as an alternative to cellular respiration. Because even though the goal, in a sense, of cellular respiration is to produce ATP, it also accomplishes something very important, which is the emptying of the taxis. There's only so many taxis in the fleet, just like in a real city. If every one of the taxis in the city is carrying passengers, then any additional passengers are just out of luck, right? There's not going to be any, there's no way to pick them up. So, cellular respiration, by allowing those taxis to deliver their electrons and protons to the chains, accomplishes the important job of reoxidizing coenzymes, emptying the taxis. That way, those taxis can drive back to glycolysis and pick more passengers up, which is a requirement for glycolysis to occur. This is why I was saying you have to have an input in the form of NAD+ for glycolysis to work. It's not enough to just have glucose. You have to have empty taxis. All right? So if all the taxis were full, that wouldn't happen. And that means oxygen deprivation would shut down everything, even the parts that don't require oxygen, like glycolysis, which would kill the individual. So there is an alternative way to reoxidize NADH back into NAD+. And that alternative to cellular respiration is called fermentation. And many, many varieties of fermentation have evolved. Any given organism or any given species just does one form of fermentation, but there's many forms that have evolved. Just the details are different, but all fermentation mechanisms have evolved for the same purpose, and they all accomplish the same thing, which is to reoxidize NADH and H+ back into NAD+. In other words, to empty the taxis, so that glycolysis can continue keeping the cell alive. Fermentation methods vary among species, and I said there are several, but there are only two given in almost all books, including the one I got this from. And that's because we tend to care only about two methods of fermentation: alcohol fermentation and lactic acid fermentation. But there are others that do the same thing in slightly different ways. The reason we care about these two is that alcohol fermentation, which occurs in yeast, for instance, is so important to us because it produces alcohol, for whether we're making it for a gasoline additive or for beer, wine, or liquor, or for bread making. There's all kinds of things that alcohol fermentation is useful for, so we care about that. And we care about lactic acid fermentation, a different method, because that's the kind of fermentation that our own bodies do. But just remember that there are other versions. Let's look at what's happening here, though. Fermentation by itself does not produce any ATP. That's not what it's for. As I said, fermentation is there as a way, as an alternative to cellular respiration, for the purpose of emptying taxis so that glycolysis can continue. All right? So it's glycolysis that produces the ATP, not fermentation. Fermentation, though, allows glycolysis to continue. In ethanol or alcohol fermentation, glycolysis, of course, as usual, spits out pyruvate, a three-carbon compound. But for species like yeast that undergo alcohol fermentation, the pyruvate is then decarboxylated, and so off comes the CO2. And what's left over is an intermediate called acetaldehyde. Acetaldehyde then gets converted into ethanol, which is why this is called alcohol fermentation. Not because the cell wants to produce alcohol, and as a matter of fact, it's producing too much of that will poison the cell and kill it. It's doing that because it wants to reoxidize NADH back into NAD+, and that's what this step does. Because the NADH drops its electrons and protons off to acetaldehyde to make the ethanol. By the way, I just said that ethanol building up would be lethal to the cells. This is why you can't make indefinitely strong beer or wine. You can only make it as strong as they will tolerate before they start poisoning themselves. If you want it stronger than that, then you kill the organisms and you distill what you have left into booze. But also notice that the fact that there's a decarboxylation step is why when you brew, when you make beer, it not only is alcoholic, but it's carbonated. The carbonation source is the decarboxylation of the pyruvate. Now, if we had this kind of fermentation in our own cells, all we'd have to do is hold our breath to get drunk. But there would be a trouble with that. So it wouldn't be a good idea. We don't want the CO2 because that would acidify our blood, which is why you can't hold your breath. A lot of people think you run out of oxygen. When your body forces you to breathe, it's because your CO2 is building up. You're not getting rid of it. And CO2 and water in your blood turns into carbonic acid. The brain stem is exquisitely sensitive to a tiny drop in pH, which the acid will cause, and that forces you to breathe. But anyway, what we do is a more direct way, really. We take our pyruvate and convert it, without decarboxylating it, convert that into lactic acid or lactate. That's the step that allows for the reoxidation of NADH back into NAD+, which can now drive back to glycolysis, allowing it to continue. Lactic acid, though, is a problem when it builds up as well. This is a big part of fatiguing. So, if you jog, you're not running so fast to outpace your body's ability to deliver oxygen. As long as you have a source of fuel, you can jog pretty much indefinitely. And that's because you can operate your lungs and your heart at high enough rate to bring in sufficient oxygen to your muscles to continuously deliver enough ATP via cellular respiration, which requires oxygen. If you sprint, on the other hand, you're using ATP so fast that you can't possibly get your lungs and heart working fast enough to deliver oxygen to the muscles quickly enough. And so your body is going to switch to fermentation, which will produce not only far less ATP, but lactic acid is going to start building up. And eventually that will acidify the blood and you'll be forced to shut down. You might want to continue to sprint, but your body is going to shut you down. We can see this alternative way, these alternative ways in which you can reoxidize NAD+ back into NAD, or I'm sorry, NADH back into NAD+ in 22 here. Glycolysis happens either way. So pyruvate is produced. That's what spits out from glycolysis. If the cell is capable of cellular respiration, like this one that has a mitochondrion, and if the final electron acceptor is available, O2, in this case, then it's certainly worth going down this route after the fork in the road, cellular respiration. Because not only will you be able to allow glycolysis to continue because cellular respiration itself reoxidizes NADH back into NAD+. But in the process, you make a hell of a lot more ATP. So certainly, this is the route to go if you can. But if oxygen's not present, or it's too low in concentration because you're sprinting, for instance, then there's this alternative that will keep the cell alive because it will allow glycolysis to continue by using a different way to reoxidize NADH back into NAD+. That is whatever kind of fermentation the cell is capable of, depending on the species. And O2 present here means, really more generally, the final electron acceptor is present. The vast majority of organisms capable of cellular respiration use oxygen as the final electron acceptor, and only oxygen, so that's why we can't change our electron acceptor. We have to have oxygen for cellular respiration. But there are species who use something else. I just want you to realize that whether it's oxygen or any other final electron acceptor, if there is electron transport going on, then that is respiration. If an organism uses cellular respiration with oxygen as the final electron acceptor, then that particular brand of cellular respiration is called aerobic respiration, because aerobic simply means in the presence of oxygen. But the species that use something other than oxygen are still undergoing respiration. The respiration part refers to the electron transport. That's what makes it, and the pumping of protons. That's what makes it respiration. In those species, though, which do not use oxygen, they use something else, then that is anaerobic respiration. Anaerobic respiration is respiration. It is not another name for fermentation. Fermentation is not respiration at all because it doesn't pump any protons. It doesn't even produce any ATP. So it is true that fermentation is anaerobic. It doesn't use any oxygen. But it is not respiration, and it's not another name. Fermentation is not another name for anaerobic respiration. We are incapable, as animals, we are incapable of anaerobic respiration. We either aerobically respire or we ferment. Those are the two possibilities. 23. The overall process we've been studying here is illustrated as this central pathway right down the middle of this figure in flowchart form. So, starting with the teal box, this is glycolysis, and these are the three parts of cellular respiration. So the overall, all four of these things are the central pathway, also called the complete oxidation of glucose. And we've studied the particulars of that from the viewpoint of entering as glucose, the master fuel, because it's most often used. But it's not the only thing that can be used as fuel. Dietarily, there are three major nutrient classes. Food is made up of three major nutrient classes, which are proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. That's why you see those on food labels. And we've studied these. Remember that carbohydrates is a real general term. Some carbohydrates are big, some are small. So carbohydrates includes polysaccharides, but it also includes monosaccharides, including glucose and other monosaccharides. All right. But anyway, food contains proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. Let's start with carbohydrates. The polysaccharides that are in food, like starch, for instance, are too big to be put into the body. They first, while they are still outside the body in the alimentary canal, need to be enzymatically digested into the monomers that we talked about that make up polysaccharides. And so that includes a bunch of monosaccharides, broken into a bunch of monosaccharides. Those are then fuel. A lot of those are glucose, but there's other things, other monosaccharides besides glucose. They are small enough, though, once the digestion occurs, to bring into the cells of the body. That's when the The food doesn't enter you. The breakdown products enter you. And if it's glucose, then it will feed right into the beginning. But if it's other kinds of monosaccharides, like fructose, for instance, well, if you went back and looked at the details of glycolysis that I showed you in earlier slides, you'll see that there are other sugars, including fructose, that are intermediates in that 10-step process. So if you're bringing in fructose instead of glucose from the diet, it just is going to skip a step in glycolysis and go to where the fructose is as an intermediate. From there on, it doesn't matter. It acts just like it came from glucose originally. And similarly for other monosaccharides, they can feed into it the glycolytic pathway or glycolysis at different points depending on what the monosaccharide is. So they're pretty easy. Carbohydrates are, in a sense, ready to go, and that's because they are the main sources of fuels. Now, fats, remember what fats are. They are lipids, but they are particular lipids that are, among other things, there for the purpose of storing energy. And so there's fat coming in as food. Fats are big molecules. They're not polymers, but they're still too big to get into the cells. So fats have to be digested as well. Well, a single fat is four pieces, right? So when you digest a fat, you break it down into a glycerol and three fatty acid molecules. Well, the glycerol is fuel that can go directly into the glycolytic pathway. So there's glycerol in this 10-step process as well. And so that can be used for energy. A fatty acid, remember, is almost a hydrocarbon. It's a hydrocarbon with a carboxyl at the end. But the hydrocarbon tail part of it is a certain number of carbons and their associated hydrogens, right? Well, if you have a fatty acid, you can use that for fuel as well, as long as you just take off two carbons at a time, at the non-carboxyl end. You know, you have so many carbons left. If you chop off two carbons and their associated hydrogens at a time, what you have is an acetyl group, just like what's left over after the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Right? You take the carboxyl off of the three-carbon pyruvate and you have an acetyl, which is two carbons. You have the same thing if you just chop two carbons off of a fatty acid tail. So you can skip glycolysis and put that acetyl right into cellular respiration, which is, or right into the citric acid cycle, which is what coenzyme A does with the acetyl that it gets from pyruvate. Does that make sense? All right. So they're pretty straightforward as well, fats. Those are the two main fuel sources. The body doesn't usually use proteins for the purpose of providing fuel. Proteins are mostly, they're much more permanent molecules. They're there for structures. They're there for sources of amino acids that can be built into our own proteins and stick around doing various other jobs. They're not really there to be burned as fuel. But they can be if the body has to use them as fuel. Once again, though, proteins are way too big to get into the body. We don't absorb proteins. We digest them first into amino acids, and then we take the amino acids into our cells. Amino acids are usually just considered building blocks to make our own proteins based in the instructions in our genes. But we can use them as fuel. There is a problem, though, with that, and that is that unlike carbohydrates and fats, which contain carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen only, amino acids contain carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, right? That's what amino means, nitrogen containing. To be an amino acid, you have to have an amino group, as we've discussed, and that nitrogen is not part of this fuel burning process that we've been talking about. So if you're going to use an amino acid from a protein as a fuel, you first have to deaminate it, get rid of the amino group. That's why NH3, ammonia, is coming out here. Ammonia is toxic at high levels, so if we do use protein as energy source, we run into the problem of having to deal with the buildup of ammonia. And that's dealt with different ways in different species. In us, we tack another job onto the long list of things the liver does. The liver takes the ammonia that builds up and converts it into something still toxic, just not as toxic, which is urea, and that becomes part of the urine. But what's left over after you deaminate it is just carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens, and depending on which amino acid of the 20 that organisms use it is, it can be fed into different parts of the central process. Skip steps, in other words, and then just undergo the rest of it. So that's how those can lead to ATP production as well. That's usually not done so much, though, unless you're starving. If you're fasting intentionally or unintentionally, then your body's going to first use your carbohydrate store, which is glycogen in us animals. You have enough glycogen if you've eaten for about a day of not eating. Once your glycogen stores are gone, the body still then has fats to work with. And so it will break down and burn all the fatty acids from the fats. When those are still, and when there's no more fat left, and by then you're non-intentionally fasting because it's becoming an emergency situation, then the body has no choice but to start breaking down the proteins in your body, which the biggest store of proteins are your muscles. So you'll lose muscle mass. The proteins are broken down into amino acids to be used as fuel. And that will maybe keep you alive until you eat again. All right, 24. Once again, we see the central process, complete oxidation of glucose in the boxes. But the purpose of this slide is to show you feedback loops that control the rate at which this set of pathways is proceeding. No cell wants to operate complete oxidation of glucose pathways at full bore all the time. That would be wasteful. Because even though it does produce ATP, it depletes the body of fuel, which might not be there all the time, especially over evolutionary time. Humans over evolutionary time have mostly been starving most of the time. That's not a problem nowadays. In fact, it's just the opposite nowadays. But anyway, it's useful to control this set of pathways, to ramp it up when appropriate, when you need more ATP, and to tone it down when you have more than you need at the moment ATP. So notice the red and blue arrows. Red ones are inhibitory. Notice that ATP itself acts as an inhibitor. And this should make sense, since it's classic negative feedback. If you have extra ATP, that really should tell you that you're running this too fast. You're making more than you need. The more ATP that is in ATP form and not being used there is, the more likely that it's going to inhibit one of the key enzymes of glycolysis, which is phosphofructokinase. When you shut down an enzyme in glycolysis, that shuts down the whole pathway, right? So too much ATP will automatically shut down the production of even more ATP. That's classic negative feedback. Citrate building up will do the same thing as well, because citrate or citric acid is that first part, that first intermediate in the steps of the citric acid cycle. Having too much of that also tells the cell, well, you're running this too fast for the moment. But AMP stimulates the pathways. So you have three major adenosine nucleotides acting as energy-carrying molecules, right? ATP and ADP, which are the two most prevalent forms. Usually, you're going back and forth between ATP, a full one, that's like a high-balance debit card, and ADP, which is partially spent, but you still have usable balance there. Normally, you would just make another deposit and turn the ADP back into ATP. But if you are using energy at a pace faster than you're producing it, You'll turn all your ATP into ADP, then you'll start using your ADP. When you dephosphorylate ADP, you make adenosine monophosphate. It just has one phosphate left. And that is a strong signal to the body that you are not making enough new ATP to keep up with demand. So AMP stimulates glycolysis and the rest of it so that you end up solving the problem. Once again, it's negative feedback. The error, in this case the error is too little ATP, gets reduced by making more. That is that chapter.